Blog Talk Radio.
Folks, and welcome to another episode of Continue Mission. And tonight, April the 21st, 2023, on Continue Mission, we will have an in-depth discussion on the current status of America. We shall have a special guest, Will Marshall from Marshall in the Middle. And Will Marshall and I go back several years, actually back to 2003 at Fort Bliss, Texas. He was one of my instructors when I went through Officer Basic Course. All of the craziness that you have heard about me, you can credit Will Marshall with that. We'll talk to him about that when he gets on the show. We also have Rich Kilblain and Father Michael Pacella on the air as well, and we'll have all of those gentlemen on here in just a few minutes. And we're going to talk about the current events and what they see and what we all see regarding the way all of this is negatively impacting, future generations. Look, let me tell you something. I don't care how many times you tell a lie. It's never going to be the truth. And here's the thing, okay? There's a few truths that you just can't get away from. Number one, men don't have babies. period. Now, I'm not trying to just hammer around on that and trying to hurt people's feelings. That's not my goal here. But we are setting a very bad precedent. You know, I remember going to school and learning what Mr., Mrs., Ms., you know, sir, yes, ma'am. And those things were all very acceptable. And it was actually, you know, it was like a standard of conduct. And we were, you know, we had our times, but most of us were respectful of each other. I see a lot of things now. It's not that way. So I know that the guests all have different perspectives, and that's what we like. Because that's what America is. It's about different perspectives. There's terrible things going on. You know, there was two people shot by unbelievable. A boy walks up, knocks on the door of a man's house, comes out, shoots him twice. Thank God he didn't kill him. But he darn sure almost did. Because you knocked on the wrong door. And because I feel terrified. We're going to talk a little bit about that. But what was even worse than that was some girls turned around in the wrong driveway and a guy come out, pow, 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 you know, and kills one of them. Killed a 20-year-old girl. And when you have dumbasses doing things like that, and excuse my language. No, don't excuse my language because it really needs to be said because that's what they are. They're ignorant. When you have idiots doing stuff like that, that makes it a lot easier for them to come take all the rest of our guns. Understand that. If you're really about Second Amendment, you're really about protecting our gun rights, then we got to make sure that idiots like those two freaks that did that don't have a gun. They don't deserve the right to own a gun. I don't care if they're American citizens. There are some people that are too nutty, crazy. And I'm not going to steal Will Marshall's thunder on that because he said some great things, and I, you know, and it had a lasting impact on me. And Rich has said some things like that as well. And some of the laws that have been implemented, you know, we went to school, we had hunter safety class, we brought guns to school, we put them in the back windshield of our cars and everything else, folks. And I can tell you, we never had a shooting. We didn't have stupidity, you know. Now, we went deer hunting. We went squirrel hunting. Sometimes we skipped school to go do those things, okay? But we didn't, you know, we didn't just, you know, do stupid things. But I'm going to tell you something. Those guys need to go to prison. And the one that killed that 20-year-old girl, really, honestly, now he's in New York, one of the most liberal states in America, okay, and with some of the strictest gun laws. And I can tell you, that guy, I mean, they should execute that guy. I'm just going to tell you that right now. That's my feelings on that. Some people may not like that, but I'm telling you, there has to come a time when you have to send a very strong message that this won't be tolerated. Now, I've got three daughters, and it would kill me. It would cut me to the bone if somebody killed one of my girls just because she was sitting in a car that happened to turn around in the wrong driveway. You better hope you get turned into the cops because a man like me will hunt you down, okay, and gut you like a fish because I'm telling you, those kids are precious to me, and that's somebody's daughter. You know, that was somebody's son that somebody, you know, darn near blew away out there. And thank God that that young man is still alive because, you know, it could have turned into an even bigger disaster. So we got to stop doing stupid. Stupid things, okay, are getting you to lose your rights, your gun owner's rights, all these things. Stupid people caused that. Now, years ago, we used to have mental institutions, and you could lock people up like that. And there's a whole bunch of people that got loose when they closed them down. And I don't know who closed them down, but by golly, they need to crank them back up. Now, I know some of them had some bad history, but they kept some real bad people off of the streets that didn't need to be on the streets. You know, I was driving home last night, case in point, driving home last night, driving through Little Point Pleasant, West Virginia. coming back from a county commissioner's meeting. Look over to my left. I see a guy standing out there in a pair of blue jeans, flip-flops, no shirt on, just rocking back and forth. Knew something was wrong with him. And I thought, well, maybe he's just drunk. Maybe he's just this. And then I looked. There were some little kids from a little league baseball team. They was out there. I mean, little itty-bitty kids out there. I said, I got to pull over here and see what's going on. So I pull over. My good friend Roy Rainey was on the phone with me. I said, I'm going to keep you on the phone, Roy, because I want you to hear what is going to happen, because this guy might be a lunatic, you know, and he might shoot me, you know, before I can get to my gun. I don't know. But as I pull up there, I sit there for a little bit, and he keeps staring at me, staring at me, staring at me. I put down the window, and I talked to him. I said, buddy, I said, are you okay? And then I realized that the man was had a knife and was trying to cut his wrist, was wanting to kill himself around all these kids. And when you get out and talk to him, you realize that the young man had some serious mental issues. But in the conversation we had for 35 minutes waiting on the police officer to show up, that's right, 35 minutes from 911, got a guy out here trying to kill himself. We're out here, we got him under control, but, you know, we probably need your help out here. The things he said was unbelievable. I'm going to go get a shotgun. I'm going to blow my mom's head off. I'm going to blow my grandmother's head off, and then I'm going to blow my head off. And that's the way my night went yesterday. And we got crazies like that that are walking the streets, and we wonder why that we have the stuff that we have going on. And you're waiting 35 minutes to get them put in an ambulance and get them sent to go get some help, whatever. The guy needs to be in some serious mental crises help. I don't know what you want to call it, but he definitely don't need to be parading around the street without a shirt on, you know what I mean? Flip-flops and a pair of blue jeans with a knife around a bunch of kids. Guys like that are going to create big problems. Or somebody's going to show up and just shoot him. You know what I mean? I mean, because some people don't have the patience, and I'm going to let Will Marshall talk about some of that as well. So I'm going to bring Rich. I'm going to bring Father Michael on here, and I'm going to bring my good friend Will Marshall in here. Will Marshall, let me tell you, I am crazy because the way you trained me down there at Fort Bliss. So the world thanks you for it, okay?
You're
on the
best,
air,
man.
Guys.
I love you, man. I love James McCormick. Dude, you're amazing. You're amazing. Thanks for having me on. It's an honor. It's an honor. And Father Mike and Mr. Kilblaine, great to be on with you guys again. I appreciate it very much, and looking forward to chatting with you guys.
Yeah. Hey, so Will, you and I talked about this thing, you know, and I think that everybody on here is upset about them two clowns that shot that kid and shot that poor 20-year-old woman. But you mentioned something about these. I forget what you called them, but I remember the conversation the other day. What's going on with these people? Why are they so nutty?
Well, a couple things. One, like I wrote an essay called The Cousin Issue. And I think that if we look to our cousins, many of us will say, you know what? That person maybe don't need a gun. That person maybe don't need this or that. And we had a red flag law way to find a way to more streamline, identify those people that are fringe, that those people that are on the edge. Like, it's just an easier way to do it. And I think those that are close enough are your cousins, right? Your cousins know. You kind of know you. And one of the other things that I have and would love to talk about is the Marshals. It's a voluntary plan. I am a Second Amendment kind of guy, but I also think that our government and laws and things that we write now aren't that effective actually in doing anything. I think that we should put together some type of a training program where all new gun owners have to attend some kind of training so that they get, and then they get a card. And millions would be grandfathered in. But the idea is that to make sure that you just go to Walmart and buy a gun or go somewhere and get an AR, that you got some training from somebody. And then the other part of the plan is the sponsorship part of it. Anytime you go to purchase a new firearm, you also have to have somebody else that has a card there with you to just to certify as a sponsor, kind of like as an uncle. Yeah, this person is doing well in the world, and you know, I'm not worried about them just losing their mind and killing anybody. And this would be a voluntary thing. It would be taken, you know, pawn shops and gun stores all over the country could begin to just say, you know what, do you have a training card? You don't? Well, you know what, I'm not going to sell you a gun. Is your sponsor here with you? No, you don't get a gun. And it's just a way we begin to police ourselves as the gun community. I was a body armor salesman for 10 years, and I was in the gun store after gun store after gun store. And what I found over time is that we turn guys away from purchasing guns all day. It's easy to do. You don't fill out this form right, you don't get a gun. But what we don't put into the mix is, hey, gun salesman, let's use some common sense. Is this person of the stable person? Do they have the training for this weapon that they're buying? What are they doing with it? Are you selling it to them just because that's your job as a retail salesman? Or are you empowered to make real decisions here? And what we have to do is we have to make, you know, there used to be a time in our society when shoe salesmen were important people. We have to go back to a time where gun salesmen are important people, where we just don't sell a gun to anybody. And I think the way we do it is by policing ourselves. And the Marshall Safety Weapons and Sponsorship Program says get you a training card to prove that you've had some training, make it easy to get grandfathered in the program for all of us good guys, and then agree as a culture, hey, if I'm going to go buy a gun, hey, buddy, come with me and be my sponsor. And the folks that we're targeting are the folks that can't get a sponsor, right? That's where it comes in is when, no, Mr. You know, so-and-so, I'm not sponsoring you. Or two guys come in that are shady, that they want to buy a gun. I've seen them turned around. No, I'm not selling you an AR. And it should be part of the culture of our gun sellers such that we police ourselves just another level. And so that's one of the things that I would say that could help prevent in certain circumstances guns getting in the hands of folks that we think that are unsafe with them or don't have the proper training or in a mentally unstable thing. And I would prefer to do it in a non-legal way because the legislation, I'm going to tell you, you guys, we all know it just doesn't work. And so I'll pause there.
Well,
when I was
in agreement with half of it, and I pointed that I text this while you guys were talking, and that is, I'm a martial arts instructor, and I teach self-defense, and here's the issue. Anybody who teaches self-defense has to teach the law. See, just because you're threatened doesn't mean you can just do whatever you need to do. I mean, you want to do to hurt that person. For example, if I hit someone, I'm hurting them and I'm going to jail. Okay, that's automatic. I can beat the charges, but anytime I throw someone down or hit somebody, I go to jail. All right. But, you know, if you knock somebody down and you start stomping that person, you're going to jail. All right. Because according to the law, once that person went down to the ground, they're not a threat anymore. Now, if they start to get up, the fight starts again. But when I teach women, I said, when you knock that guy down, if you knock that guy down, you can finish him off and make sure he does not get up because you are in fear of your life. The law applies differently. All right. And so it's the same thing about guns. On gun ownership requires responsibility. You need to know the law. I am against the states where they just allow anybody the right to concealed carry. We had that in Oklahoma where I think it was a doctor, you know, some guy, you know, broken, you know, was causing some kind of trouble. He went outside, shot the guy while he was running away. If he's running away, he's not a threat. The doctor went to jail. You got to know the law. And just gun safety. That's, you know, and most of my friends who are gun dealers, they pay attention to first-time buyers. And you can tell who a first-time buyer is. And a lot of them, like, I don't know what, you know, what they see the selection of guns. I mean, which one do I get? And they'll advise them, go to a shooting range and check out some guns and fire them. But first of all, you need to learn gun safety. You need to learn, you know, that. I mean, we grew up with it as kids in Oklahoma. Now, oh, and that's what the NRA used to do. The NRA used to teach gun safety and marksmanship. They don't do it anymore. They got greedy. They've become a lobby organization. So we, in reality, we need another organization to step up and teach gun safety and, you know, the law. Now, sponsorship. That sucks. You just told me I can't buy a gun because I don't have a whole lot of friends anymore at my age. I, you know, it's like, who am I going to get to go? And you know, it's, I got to ask the few friends I have, it's like, hey, look, would you come over and vouch for me? That's the stupidest idea I ever heard. I mean, it may be good for young people who probably have a lot of friends. But again, they can get that one friend who will vouch for you regardless how crazy you are.
I want to make a few comments. When I was in Connecticut, I had a permit to carry concealed. I had to go through the city, have letters from neighbors, and then I had to be thoroughly investigated so that I could have a permit to carry throughout the whole state. Now, when my son moved from Georgia and went to take a job in New Jersey, I had to fill out paperwork. One of many for him to kind of vouch for his character and things of that nature. Now, I had the NRA training, safety. We had to have a certificate. So I think there are a lot of safety measures. And, you know, we have to talk them out a little more. But we have to offer something other than you can just go to a gun show or just go to a gun store and, you know, get a quick background check and you're out of there. So I think what Will's sharing is some important stuff. It just needs perhaps to be modified.
And how many guns do you own, Father Michael?
I don't really want to divulge that to everybody.
Well, I'll tell you right now, I own an arsenal, okay? I am a collector. I am a collector, okay? And I just won the bid on a FN M16A2 upper receiver. That's the one piece I needed to complete this build that I put together. There's people like me who have lots of guns. We're collectors, and that would be a very big inconvenience. Now, the thing about having some, you know, like your concealed carry or whatever, having someone vouch for you, right? But to have that person have to go with you to buy the gun, you're just trying to say we can't buy guns anymore. That is a real inconvenience. Father Michael, you're the only friend I got left. You would be the guy I would have, and I buy my guns through Jeremy Jones in Virginia Beach. So tell me, Father Michael, how easy is it for me to get you to drive with me through Virginia Beach to pick up, you know, a lower receiver?
like I said, in Connecticut, I had to have letters that were, and I had an interview with
the
captain.
I get the letters. I can deal with the letters.
Yeah.
I can deal with the letters. But the idea is if you have to be accompanied by somebody, that's the problem. Okay.
But
no, especially like concealed, you know, in a case like that.
I want to give Will Marshall a chance because he's trying to respond to some of that. But I think what you heard Will, you may have not heard what Will said in the beginning. There would be many that would be grandfathered in. So, you know, obviously, Rich, you know, you really are a grandfather anyway. So, you know, like the rest of
Well, we'd also point out that probably anybody, well, it's like concealed carry. Anybody who's prior service qualifies for concealed carry. All right.
Now,
so, you know, you're looking at people with my background. It should be like, you know, if you're, I would say anybody who's a special former special operator should be able to buy automatic weapons. They are not the threat. In fact, with terrorism the way it is, you're probably wanting these guys to be armed.
So what I'd like to get Will's response. So Will had a few responses there. Go ahead, Will.
Yeah, so respectfully, I would like to say that a couple things. One, the human connection is what we're looking for in the sponsorship program, both for our younger gun owners and also, believe it or not, for our older gun owners. As we have less friends as we're young, many times we have less friends when we're old. And I will tell you that not having enough friends to find someone to vouch for you puts you in a special category. I'll tell you another thing that I think, that having multiple guns and identifying as a collector or as an aficionado, I'll tell you many times what we find out is that really that is a fetish. And many times that can be a problem. I'm not saying it is for the people that might be listening here. But it's obvious over time that people that have lots and lots and lots of guns and then tell me that they don't have any friends, well, interesting, okay, maybe you don't need any guns. And so I really think that the sponsorship part of the program, getting at the marginalized people, is important. We need to be proud if we're going to go get a gun. If you got 30 guns, maybe you don't need to go get another one. You know, what is it about the gun that you have to have, and why is it? Is it a trophy? Is it something we fondle and play with on the weekends, or is it a tool that we, you know, blow things up with? I would like to think that our weapon is something that we think of as maybe for personal survival, those kinds of things, and not for assaulting our neighbors.
Yeah, well, you know, I've heard a
you
story.
A lot.
About,
all right, I want to address a couple of those issues. All right,
Let me say this one thing real quick. So gunfighters, and Rich, you and I had this conversation. Gunfighters were so good because they only had one or two guns, and they constantly practiced and trained with that thing. You know, I have firearms, obviously everybody around here does. But I have probably two pistols and I have a rifle that I'm really, really good with. And those would be the ones that I would pick up and take with me if I needed to go hunt or shoot, you know, or whatever. So I get what you're saying on that, Will. Now, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Rich. I wanted to just point that out.
Oh, okay. Yeah, but I was going to acknowledge the fetish part. Okay, I was primarily a military antique collector, and I'll leave you with this joke. Do you want to know what the difference between a collector and a hoarder is? Space.
What? There you go.
Space.
Right. You're a collector.
Space.
You still got enough space.
Yeah. If you can, if you got enough room to organize it, it's a collection. But if it's just piled
you
up, you're a hoarder. And you know, I joke and like people who want to start a military antique collection, I said, you'd be better off getting a drug habit because it's cheaper.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, because, no, it becomes a passion and you get it. See, here's the thing is, okay, so when you're collecting, you know, my dad started collecting patches, you know, U.S. Army patches. And then we begin to find out during World War II, there was like six or seven different manufacturers. So there's six or seven different variations. So you start counting stitches and stuff like that. You look for the variation. And it carries over into gun collecting. For example, you know, it's like you could build a whole collection out of, you know, 1903 Springfields. Okay,
yeah.
Because there's so many differences in them in the years that they were made. I went over to a guy's house. All he collected was M1 Grands. His basement was lined with M1 Grands, and every one of them was different. Okay, so when you're dealing with collectors, fetish, passion, whatever word you want, but yes, it's there. But we really get into the very. And I will tell you this. So when I started building. I'll call them M16 clones, right? Because, you know, my collection of I've never been able to get an M14, but I have. And what I do with my collection is, well, not anymore because the woman we had, the female director of our museum, who really loved doing an outreach program, has left. And the new guy, the replacer, does, but none of his staff wants to go out. Do an outreach program, and they can't take their stuff out. It has to be protected. So they tap into collectors like me because, hey, you know, we can allow you to play with our stuff. And so I bring that. And I always had one of each type of infantry weapon throughout history. But I stopped. I didn't have anything for, you know, like the Vietnam War, the M16s, until I found out, like, you can buy surplus U.S. government parts except for the lower receiver. And we call those clones, right? And I started building those. You know,
yeah.
I spent my career playing with the M16 and had no idea of all the little variations with it. And I've been having fun building these, okay? But I got to stop. It just, it, you know, I might as well just start doing drugs because this hobby is too expensive.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, let's do this. So I want to go back to this conversation that Will and I was having earlier. And Will, you know, I want to go back to the shootings of the young man and the young lady. And you said something. This is what really resonated. You said, man, there are these people that just sit around and they just think about, man, I can't wait till I shoot somebody. And they just, how did you say that? Because how you said that, I'm thinking like what you're saying, and I'm thinking, am I the only person that feels that way, that there are people that literally sit around and dream about shooting people? But there really are lunatics like that. And what's your thoughts on that? How did you say that again? Just run me through that again.
Okay. So I'll tell you where it started, okay? It started one day. When I was in, I was at an appointment. So I'm selling body armor to law enforcement, okay? And so I'm with law enforcement agencies all over the Southeast, interfacing with SWAT team commanders, all that. Like, I did that for 10 years, okay? And towards the end, I was sitting in a booth with like he was one of my distributors, and he was carrying. I was carrying. Several was carrying. It was part of the culture. And one of the things that like, as I sat down in the booth, he was like, are you on the outside or the inside? Are you the this guy or the that guy? And he was talking about, like, stack positions and whatever. Mm. And I was like, what are you talking about? And what he was saying was, if shit goes down, which way are you going? And, like, he was wanting to do a battle drill in the restaurant. Like he had never been in the military. He had – he was like a wannabe gun guy. And so he wanted to talk tactics with me. And so me being me, I'm like, well, you know, well, talk to me. Tell me about what you're thinking about. And so he explained to me how – ever since he had got his concealed carry permit, that every time he went into anywhere he was at, that he began to, and he called it fantasize about what would happen if something bad happened. where would the bad guy come from? What would it look like? Where would he go? What he would do? And the whole dream and his fantasy was him being the good guy that saved the day, that killed the bad guy. Mm-hmm. And it was something that he always he's like you don't think about that when every place you go, because he thought that's what we all did. And I was a safe guy to talk to because I wasn't a cop and I was older and stuff. And so he thought that everybody that went into anywhere, the first thing they thought of was, how am I going to fight my way out of that?
Mm-hmm,
and
coffee.
I when I thought that way, in a way, because I will tell you, it gets crazy if you think about what you would do if your wife or kids got threatened or, you know, hurt or whatever. And I got to the point, James, where I had to put my weapon down. As a matter of fact, I've given my weapons away.
Mm-hmm.
I like, technically, there's weapons in the safe. I have an AR. It's in the safe. It's either at the safe or at the safe of the hunting property. I don't know. But, you know, it's not like a family weapon or whatever. But all my, like, my pistols and the things that I had that are my, that were my personal weapons, I have literally given them to my friends. I've
mm-hmm.
literally said, like, I have a friend of mine who's a sheriff's deputy in Florida, and he needed an off-duty weapon, and I had a 26, so I gave it to him. You know, here's your holster, here's everything. You know, just take it. Because I'm never going to shoot anybody, ever. I'm never going to put myself in a place to shoot anybody. Like Jesus, I would rather you shoot me and my family than me have to shoot you. But let me tell you, I might throw some fists. I might kick the shit out of you. I might run. I might do whatever, but I'm not going to shoot you. Right?
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. I'm not going to lay in the floor and watch you hurt my children or my wife or anything like that. But I'm mm-hmm. also not going to double tap you before you cross the road. What's happened now, and so let's get to this marginalized group of people, okay? So this marginalized group of people are sitting around, and what they're doing is then they're fantasizing in their head, oh, my gosh, I think I might have to shoot somebody. I think I might have to shoot somebody. And they, thing you know, they're finding reasons to justify it legally and morally and whatever, and they're pulling the trigger because for some reason they think they're going to be a hero. They have some crazy thought in their mind. The other thing that we don't all actually think about is that 80% of our society is medicated in some way right now.
Right.
Whether it's legal, illegal, whether it's medicated with just too much damn TV or Yellowstone or whatever, you become anesthetized to violence and different things. And it's just a wild situation. But I'll tell you, our gun culture, the Soldier of Fortune magazine, just like this latest leaker. This leaker was not – he's not a spy. He's just a braggart. He's just a kid trying to brag for his buddies and to show off. And he's he's an idiot. He's an idiot. But but he's not a spy. He's not a spy. I read into that, deep into that, and it's neat what's coming out. Okay, so the thing he did is he started coming and he started writing down the stuff he knew and putting it on that Discord server for his buddies because he was the OG. Right? And so he's writing it all up, typing it all up and whatever. And then he gets mad at them because they're not reading it. There's like 22 of them or whatever this guy said. And so he gets mad at them that they're not reading and responding. So that's when he starts taking the pictures of it. He starts printing it out, folding it up, putting it in his cargo pocket, taking it out. And it was all good until somebody else tried to show off outside the server. One of his little group that was in the server is how it got out, how all that mm-hmm. stuff got out. It is amazing, the stuff. But he wasn't trying to sell stuff to Israel or anything. He was just bragging to his buddies.
Yeah, and you know, and you feel bad for that kid's family. And I watched that thing, and it's like, you know, what has happened is exactly what you said has happened. People literally sit around, and the fantasizing is the big thing. And Father Michael, as we talked about last week and the week before, when we talk about, you know, bad things or sin begins with a thought. You know what I mean? And Father Michael, what's your view on this fantasizing culture that is sitting around and fantasizing about, you know, and you know, they want to be a hero, and I get that. I understand. We all grew up as kids. You know, we wanted to be the hero that come in to save the day. We've all fantasized about that as kids. But these are adults. These are grown adults that are literally sitting around thinking about, you know, if somebody comes to my door, they turn around in my driveway, it's my property, I can just shoot them. What's your thoughts on that, Father Mike, spiritually?
Well, anytime you fantasize, you know, and are out of touch with reality, you know, I work with college students, been teaching over 20 years in university as well as pastoring, and, you know, their brains aren't developed until they're 25 or 30 years old. Mm-hmm. And as Will said, there are, you know, some wannabes, and I think that every person has to sit down and count the cost, because if you have a weapon, there is a possibility you'll have to use it. Now, no one wants to kill anyone, you know, by accident or, you know, but when it comes to defending yourself and your family, I had four daughters, you know, you feel vulnerable, especially when you start to get older. And, you know, I'm probably the oldest out of our group. And so, no, I think that the immaturity that Will's pointing out and the need for education and instruction, you know how some people are, and I've worked with police departments for a long time, and I'm about to work with another one. You know, they put people in these simulated situations, you know, to see what they'll do. So I do think there has to be a reality check if you haven't been in the military. You know, we marched with M1s, even in the Navy during Vietnam. And, of course, when I was a chaplain at Bragg and in the Army all those years and stuff like that, I did shoot at times, but, you know, we're non-combatants. So, yeah, I think fantasy can become sin. I mean, Jesus said if you look upon a woman to lust in your heart, you know, you've committed adultery. So I think it is sinful. And right. It is a lust, I think, for power. And, you know, so I agree with Will. There are psychological, you know, even in the military. I mean, we've had to chapter people out, you know, who just weren't right. You know, they had the wrong motivation as far as what we do and so on and so forth. So, yeah, I think we have to be our brother's keeper. You know, I'm a little concerned if there are too many safeguards and you lose that. But I think we have to become a community again. And, you know, we have to confront people, especially if they're medicated. You know, I've been teaching, and a lot of the students, it comes out. You wouldn't believe how many are on medication. And I'll be honest with you, I've had to confront some students, and I have thought with their backpacks, I have thought there's some odd students that it's very possible that they would, you know, pull a gun. I mean, I'm straight. I'm a straight shooter. I love people. I care for them. But, you know, so we live in a dangerous world, and I'm not saying we should recreate the Wild West, but I think that, and I mentioned again, as an older community, I'm not in a 55 or older, but you feel more vulnerable, and all you want to do is to protect and to deter, and not a lust for death, because even if you deal with it with the law, you'll go before the Lord if it was premeditated murder. But self-defense is a God-given right, whether you do it physically or with a weapon legitimately.
Right.
Okay. All right. So it sounds like I'm guilty. And I'm probably not qualified to be security for your church anymore, because I fantasize, using the term Will has used, I fantasize over somebody walking into our church to shoot our congregation.
Right.
Right. I'm going to use the word visualization or visualize. Father Mike, because of church shootings, because there is an actual threat out there. Church shootings. several of us have been, and the Catholic Church does it. I mean, yeah, I know the Catholic Church has designated shooters.
All right.
And Father Michael appointed me and Ron. Ron, retired military police command sergeant major, and then he retired as a captain in law enforcement. Yeah, he was my backup. Now, okay, I'll put this out up front. I don't carry. The reason I don't carry, I'm not against concealed carry. I don't carry because I believe it's too easy a solution. I don't want to be put in a position, because if you draw a gun, you only have two choices, use it or put it away. I don't want to be put in that
right.
situation. But in a case of an active shooter, I'm screwed, okay, because I have to visualize that person coming in there,
mm-hmm.
and I have to confront them. And everybody in the church knows where I sit. I sit in that right front seat so I can see the door. And Ron sat behind me, and you know, we had fantasized, okay, we had fantasized how we were going to react. Okay, and Ron, with plenty of police, he said, because I told him, I said, I'm going to rush him, unarmed. I'm going to, if I see a threat, no, I mean, normally what I do is I'm going to get up. Most of the people are not going to walk in with the gun in hand. They're going to walk in, and I'm going to go up and greet them. But if they were, I'm fantasizing, if they did come in with a gun, I have to charge him. And Ron told me, he said, that will probably throw him off. They don't expect
mm-hmm.
that. And he said,
mm-hmm.
I'll be right behind you. Well, Ron has passed away, and so Larry's my backup. And Larry and I have fantasized about how, I'm like, okay. So he's like, I see you move. I know something's going down. And so there it is. And, Will, when you go into a restaurant, do you sit with your back against the wall so you can see the door?
Believe it or not, I like to consider the person that I'm with, and however they want to sit, generally I let them pick.
Oh, I can't. Now, the only time I can sit with my back to the door is if I'm with another veteran. That's the only and then what we're doing, we're both watching each other's back. And a funny story about that is, I told this in church after Ron passed away, that Ron and I went to lunch together. And I instinctively went to the seat because you're going to say fantasize. I'm like, hey, I'm in a habit that when my wife asked me about, because we have these active shooters, and she got concerned about it. And I had to teach her. I said, okay, because she knew I always had to sit with my back against the wall. And I said, when you sit down, you have to be able to see who comes through the door, but you also have to know where the exits are. How are you going to get out? See, for me, I'm not going to be carrying. So I'm not going to be able, if I have to charge that person, it's because I got no other choice. So, it's like as soon as I said it, and I would work with her on it. I would say, okay, where's the exits? Where's the kitchen? Where's the entrance to the kitchen? You got to know these things, okay? The bathroom's over there. Well, you just boxed yourself in. You can't get out. So I am fantasizing about an active shooter coming in and what I would do. But my training, okay, I was trained to do that. Now, the funny part is Ron and I walked into a restaurant and immediately went to the seat in the booth facing the door. And I looked at Ron and I'm like, oh, you're probably more paranoid than I am. He was a police officer, and he has that, how he has that funny grin. I said, you probably want to sit here. He just kind of nodded his head. I said, okay, you can have it. We sit down. Yes, Will, I am guilty. I fantasize about active shooters coming into our church, into a restaurant, into public places because it happens. And I have to have a plan. I instinctively, from my SF days, have to have a plan for how I'm going to react to it. because it is a reality. Okay?
I agree with you. I think, though, what Will is saying about wannabes, Rich, you're not a wannabe. Okay? You've been there, done that. The shirt is so old you can't wear it anymore. No, I appreciate because of the mental state.
Wait. I take that as insult because I am losing. I am in really good shape now. No,
not shape. The shirt is old. That's what I'm saying. It has nothing to do with your shape.
Okay. Keep going. I'm sorry.
Nothing to do. You did. You lost 10 pounds since you've been retired. That's admirable.
That's right.
I appreciate what Will's saying because I've dealt with people that are delicate mentally. I had a call today. As a matter of fact, a parent tried to call me during the show to reach out to their son who's in a mental institution. And, people, are on the edge. I know from working in the college as far as the suicide, the depression, the despair. And I think what Will is saying, we need to be involved a little bit and maybe ask some questions. I remember when I went through the NRA training, and a lot of it was safety and, things of that nature. I was in the class with a very experienced shooter. He was on the shooting team at the Coast Guard Academy, he's in my church. And so I agree with you 100%, Rich. You have to have a plan. But I think we have to deal with some people, who for the wrong reason are looking for a fight. See, you're not looking for a fight. You don't want to fight. But if you have to fight, then look out. And I think what Will is trying to say, and I don't want to speak for him, but there are people who are looking for a fight. And
I'll be
prepared.
Okay. If an active shooter comes into the restaurant I'm in, because I'm not armed, okay, all I'm thinking about is getting my wife out of there. I hope there's a guy in there that's fantasizing about killing him. Because if he's not,
remember that one guy
about killing
when
him,
the guy came
no,
in?
No, I'm talking about a guy that's armed.
Yeah, did you
everybody
see the one
else.
In Texas?
He is not fantasizing
the guy
about killing that
everybody.
Guy.
Came in and robbed everybody.
What?
Did you see the one in Texas? The guy came in. It was a kid, really. He robbed everybody. He had a fake gun, and he was robbing everybody. And the guy killed him. And
that sounds
said,
like justifiable homicide to me.
Yeah, there was no charge. He happened to be armed, and the guy was masked, and he was robbing everybody and making them think that he would shoot them with his fake gun if they didn't give up what they had. So, planning, I mean, really, too, seriously, in church, I think, if I'm standing in the altar, they're going to want me. And so, no, I think that you have to have an exit plan. You have to, be responsible. Can I tell a quick story? When I was at an all-black college, I taught there for 7 years. I used to teach in an auditorium. So, how the auditorium is, the professor's down at the bottom, and it goes up gradually. Well, there were a couple of men who weren't the color of my students that all of a sudden showed up in this booth. And my students were getting nervous. And I had like 62 students. Now, I knew that if I had them go out the bottom exit, that the shooters would have had the high ground and they could pick them off. And so what I did is I left my position. I ran up the stairs. I confronted them both. Said, "What are you?" Oh, they told us no one was here. What are you talking about? I have 2-3 classes back to back. My students were totally nervous about it, and I just think that you have to have a plan like that. If I were to dismiss them and told them to go out the door on the bottom, and they were shooters, they'd pick them off as they go out. So the plan would have been to charge up the stairs, toward them where they wouldn't have easy and get out of the place, use that exit. So, no, I think, Rich, you're talking, good tactics, good strategy. But I am concerned about people who fantasize about a lot of things because, you know, they have this a self-aggrandizement type of mindset. And I think it all has to do with maturity. You know, a lot of these shooters have been young, and I'm very cognizant. I had a couple of students act up the other day, and I had to confront them. You know, big guy, you know, and another person, and their minds aren't, they're not developed. Now, I was in the military at 17 in a war zone. You know, I consider myself an adult. I got, you know, graded as an adult. But a lot of these, they want you to give them a break. I'm not really an adult. But in one way, their independence makes them think that they are. But when someone's brain is not functioning, it's not fully developed, I think those people put all of us in danger. And I think that's got to be our target more than someone who's had more life experience.
Actually, you've nailed it, all right? The real problem. There is no gun law that you can impose that is going to prevent someone from killing a lot of people, okay? It is how do we identify those people who are a threat to themselves or threat to other people, okay? And now, I love a good argument. I like to play the devil's advocate, okay? So I was having fun with your term fantasizing. Yeah, there are some people that don't need to own guns. How do you identify them? That is going to be the real challenge. Okay.
Yes, 1,000%. Totally agree. Father Michael, thanks for your input there. I totally agree. It's that marginalized group, and they tend to be younger rather than older. And Richard, I think you hit the nail on the head in really going overboard in, you know, doing your battle drills and your pre-combat checks and pre-combat inspections that you were doing with your teammate there, right? You get that you're planning your battle drills, and that's what trained people do. Marginalized people do what you are laughingly calling fantasizing, what I'm saying, right? You're a pro. You're doing it the right way. There are so many people that have zero training, that don't have any idea what they're doing, and they're wanting to be that Barney Fife, right? They're wanting to, why did the sheriff make Barney put his bullet in his pocket, right? Because he's afraid he's going to shoot somebody. So
yeah.
Wanting to do that, right? Make sure that the Barney Fifes of the world are properly controlled.
There
right?
you go.
Yeah. How do we identify those guys? Yeah. Actually, here's something I want to point out.
Let me just say how you and I have talked
ahead.
About that, because I wrote a book, Will, called From Valor to Virtue, The Moral Development of the Brave. And I've worked with police officers, and, of course, I taught ethics in the Army. And Rich kept pointing that out about the Barney Fifes and how do some, you know, because we've seen some real stupid movements on behalf of immature police or untrained, and yet, you know, we want to become the Andy Griffith. And so I think that's a great comparison, and that helps us, at least people in our generation, understand exactly what you're saying.
Yeah. Here's something. As a martial arts instructor, you know, you can't get high schools to teach any form of wrestling. But no, they won't have a boxing team or stuff like that, or they won't allow martial arts to be taught in their school because they're afraid everybody's going to go around and start beating each other up. One of the things we find, and you hear this over and over and over again from martial arts instructors, trained martial artists don't get in fights. They don't
That's
get
true.
In fights. Why? Why? They get it out of their system in the cage or the ring, whatever they're bringing in there, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, most of them come in there, they're probably bullied or whatever. Okay, but there, you develop a certain level of confidence. Like when someone threatens you, you look at them like, I can kick your ass. And this situation doesn't escalate, okay? I had one of my senseis tell me that he was into the spiritual side and that you spiritually calm the situation. Whatever it is, martial arts, don't get in fights. unless they are forced into it. I wonder if we set up a combatives course, you know, like Special Forces has or the police officer has, where you get to go in there, not on a video game, but actually go in there and pop caps, okay? If that's enough to get it out of your system that you don't need to fantasize about it. I wonder if there's a correlation there.
I know my wife took a combatives course, and my son, you know, he won 167 bouts in wrestling, and 120 by pin, and 39 loss, and he never had a fight. And I think that again, what you're saying, Rich, is important training, so you're not insecure, so you don't want to be a wannabe. You know, because you've been bullied or whatever the situation is. I think it goes back to what Will was saying. There's a psychological problem here. And I think as a community, we have to recognize that and see if we can't rectify it and help a person understand that's not security. And it could mess up the rest of your life. I mean, we see a lot of these gang members. You gentlemen know I have a cousin who's a police officer in Chicago, and you can see they're not trained just the way they hold, you know, the weapon, and so on and so forth. So I think we do need to police ourselves. I used to teach ethics in the Army and for the police, and I used to tell them what you said, Will. If we don't police ourselves, CNN's going to police us, and so you know we've got to be self-deprecating. And we've got to be honest. And I think what you're saying, Will, is so important. And, Rich, there's a good balance there. But I do think we have to police ourselves. You know, one of the great generals of the Civil War said, I will not put any man in command who cannot command himself.
Amen. I think... So a couple things. One, I want to get to a throwback about mental health in our country that James was talking about early on. But before I go there, I really want to talk about the point you were making there and how valid it is that we have to find a way to develop personal responsibility in each American. Like it kind of was maybe in the older days. I'm not saying that Americans don't. I'm just saying it seems like when I was a kid, I was responsible for maybe pulling maybe more weight than maybe the kids are today, and it's the same for my father's generation. It's almost exponential. Like the easier I have it, the harder my kids are going to have it in a way, you know, and it's a wave that goes back and forth. But one of the things that honestly, I'm going to tell you, this isn't very popular, but I think it should be. One of the things that's issue with our mental health program in our country right now is that we don't have any real centralized government health care. If we did, then we would have to build medical institutions for those of us that aren't getting along very well. I was talking to my dad. I don't know if you realize this, but my father was a product of rape. A very prominent community member raped my father's mother, who was at the time she was considered retarded. Now we would say that she had Down syndrome. And so my father was a product of a rape in a very prominent community here in South Alabama. And a lot of people knew the truth, but he was never raised that way. You know, I am trans. When I was born, I was swaddled in a pink blanket and announced to the world as a little girl. But a couple of days later, they noticed that something wasn't right down there, and they did a hernia surgery, and a little boy appeared. And here I am today. You know, our world is a lot deeper than we might think it is. And one of the things that we need to do is really, really begin to take care of the health, both mental and physical health of our society. I believe if we were able to go to some kind of national health care system where our basic health care services were covered in a national way, our marginalized citizens would be a lot easier to get help. The issue now is nobody's willing to pay for that care. In the old days, the Baptists, the seminaries, and the Methodists and the Catholics, they all had basically mental wards. That's where my real grandmother went to die after they took my dad away from her. And she went away, and basically she died in filth and squalor because they didn't keep them up. They didn't donate to them, and there was no government insight. It was just a place where you put marginalized citizens, like a leper colony. And so
right. Okay.
I think that if we came up with some kind of supervised government health care, then we would have a chance at least having a way for help.
All right. I'm in agreement with one part and not the other, the government part. Get the government out of it. When the government ran it, you had these snake pits. You had these insane asylums. I spent 2.5 years working in we call this the Opportunity Center, but everything's been revised. Actually, it was Geraldo Rivera. He did an expose on one of those mental health institutions in New York that, I mean, it just brought tears to everybody's eyes. And so the focus for us was quality of life, but I worked 2.5 years with the mentally handicapped, and I'm very proud of that. Now, the thing is, it was a private institution, government funded. Okay. The thing is, tries to run, they will screw it up. And we had a guy on who, he had the best advice. He said, what the government needs to do is not try, you know, because there's so much bureaucracy, they'll screw it up. Find the successful operations and fund them. But you're right. You're right. We need to invest more. Instead of trying to take guns away from, you know, law-abiding citizens, because you can't get them out of the hands of the criminals. And every time we have a mass shooting, the thing we point out is there is no gun control law that would have prevented that. But if we do invest more in mental health opportunities, that and I think this is a good segue to what we were originally going to talk about, is this marginalized generation. We have a lost generation. Okay.
Yes.
And, you know, they need help. And think, you know, when you say, let's have the centralized government mental health, oh no, they will screw it up. And really, what the government wants is control. This is my firm belief. The government, okay, let's just talk about the Democrats. They want big they want big government. They want everybody dependent on the government. Why? So they can control them. They can control them. That's what communism is. Socialist countries about is where you give up your individuality, your freedom and stuff for comfort. Yeah, okay, if you want that, but most of us don't, right? But we definitely need to fund mental health. Okay, so that's my point. I think we need to talk about that. This is a good segue to that lost generation.
Can I just list a couple of things? Because I work so closely with young people that I see, so that then we can analyze that. You know, the whole thing with climate change and, you know, the sky is falling and the fearfulness, even going through the pandemic, there's not a lot of hope. James pointed out some time ago, and I also saw it, a young boy, I believe it was Las Vegas, committed suicide. He was like 9 or 10, said he had nothing to look forward to. There's so many factors here, and we have to take responsibility because they're our children. In the same way, both my parents were born in 1918, and after the war, we were indulged in, and, you know, born in the 50s and the 60s. And a lot of that was, you know, happy days are here again. And so they're
basically the offspring of things that we have sown as well. And they've also been sold a bill of goods. But the thing that concerns me the most, and James brought this up in our conversation last week, is the despair and hopelessness. Now, we know as believers that Christ is our hope, and there's hope in God's love and grace and purpose and future. But I look at the children, young people, they come in a big class. They don't talk to each other. They're not socially connected. They're on their phones until I tell them to put them away. And you look at some of their eyes, and there's an emptiness. And I'm really concerned, a lack of real purpose and drive. Now, there are exceptions. People come from different families, or they're ambitious, or they're athletic, or things of that nature. But I think we're dealing with hopelessness, despair, fear, no hope for the future.
I agree 100%, Father Michael. I agree. And it's an interesting thing to think about what, like, I have a brand new, you know, 2-year-old granddaughter, and to think about what the future holds for her. I hope maybe one of these days that we're able to look around and decide that we would rather be humans rather than Americans. I see us causing a lot of problems, pointing at each other and finding ways to fault others and not be human beings and not be kind and loving. And we do that both with our neighbors. We do that with those that don't look like us. We do that with people from other countries. I watch our media. We're constantly pointing to Russians and Chinas and Iranians and anybody we can point to for our problems, while at the same time we're watching our cousins starve down the street in squalor while we're sitting in a nice huge house and don't care about our neighbors. It's really wild how we're allowing ourselves to point at others and say that they're wrong and they're bad, and literally throw bombs in their direction, all the while not connecting with the people that are around us. And I'm as guilty as anybody. It's just literally our culture. And I think that over time, if we were able to find some way to be less judgmental and less mean and more sponsorish and more training with everyone, right? When I say I want a sponsor, I want an uncle to teach somebody about a gun and to take them to the range, go to class with them, and then go in there and buy their first gun with them. And it'd be a culture, you know, hey, look, Ted, my buddy down the street wanted to buy a new pistol, and so he invited me over here. Of course, I'm going to sponsor him. I love him, man. We go to church together, you know, and you sign, and off you go. It's a cool thing, but I don't want the person that, and we could label, we could put any letter we want, we could label it any way we want, but the typical thing is, one, not like us, and two, we're afraid that they might hurt somebody. Those are the ones that are not going to be able to get a sponsor, and those are the ones that we do want to keep. And is it going to solve everything? No, but at least it's a voluntary step in the right direction that we're not waiting on some legislation about, which we know is friggin' crap to begin with.
You know, Will, it's
actually,
a great start.
Actually, what you just described was joining the gun club.
Right, join the gun club.
Community.
Then you get the card.
Right.
It's not that you need you. It's not that you for first-time buyers who have no experience with a gun. It's not that you need someone to come in. No, you need to join a gun club so that you're with people who are more experienced than you. I remember when I went through college, was working on my master's degree. One of our peers. He came from New York, where he's never allowed to own a handgun. Now he's in California. He can own. He's buying them. And he goes shooting range, and he has no experience in this. And he can't even, he's missing the damn target. So when he found out about my background, he asked me to come in, like, hey, would you go shooting with me? And I'm like, he's going to pay for all the ammo. I'm like, hey, I'm bringing my guns too. Okay. So I teach him, like, steady hold factors, right? You know, and all of a sudden he started hitting inside the circles, maybe not the black circle, but he's starting to hit the paper, okay? He's not pulling the trigger. So I'm teaching the basics of it. But you know, I come from a culture, look, when I go to reunions with my guys, we went out to Texas. You know, we're all like drinking and shooting. And a guy, he had a ranch, and he had his backyard set up as a range, okay? And guys were bringing their guns, and everybody was picking up, trying them out. I mean, for me, because I'm missing my trigger finger on my right hand, you know, I pointed out my problem of pull with my middle finger. And so it's longer than the right index finger, and so my contact is a little bit off, and I have to squeeze. And this one guy goes, get a wider pistol grip. Oh, my gosh, I never thought of that. But here it is. Mm-hmm. We're all like friends. Join a gun club and get the other. Well, anyway, after that time, you know, he's like, after he learned how to hit the paper, then he went and found a friend who was a police officer, taught him like real, you know, better marksmanship training. And so that's the idea. There's camaraderie, there's fellowship. Yes. Okay. So that's what I
thought. I think that's great. I had been a part of a gun club with a lot of guys in our church, and it was a lot of fun. And what you're saying makes a lot of sense about those who are experienced. But something Will said I thought was a very good starting point. I remember when I went to basic training, and they asked, what was your race? And my first inclination was to write down human. I'm part of the human race. And of course, during those days, believe me, we had a lot of racial problems, fights, even during Vietnam, fighting each other, Marines and sailors and different things like that. I didn't go into the Army till later, but you had your problems too. And I think the sense of community, like you were saying, with the gun club, but I think we have to be careful not to give love bombs just to make people feel accepted, you know, if they're being careless. I think when you're in a community, you also lovingly correct one another. You know, acceptance is important. God's grace is important. But there are times that we have to confront. And if somebody's really acting unbecomingly, especially with a weapon or whatever they might be doing, we have a moral responsibility to one another, especially those we're in relationship with, and to say, hey, man, you've been drinking. Put the gun down. Or whatever it might be. One of my soldiers died in a one-car accident. You know, I had to bring his body home. And they didn't take his keys away from him. He was cutting. I had told my command that he was on a downward spiral. Was he going to kill someone or kill himself? He was dead in a month. We need to speak up. You know, that's what community is. And I think the gun club is a great, great example, because these are people who understand.
That's just a solution for the people who want to buy guns. But I think what we wanted to talk about is that lost generation who live in the virtual world, have no human contact, when we look at the background of almost all the school shooters, the mass shooters, you know, the common thing is loners, isolated, all right? And a lot of them grew up in a single family parent, you know, they had no father, they had no father figure and stuff like that. Why do people join gangs? The thing is, it becomes a family, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is, all right, we used to joke about it, like, okay, for example, the difference between the Marines and a gang is adult leadership. Well, there's a little bit of truth to that, okay? So in the gangs, it's just a bunch of older adolescents leading adolescents, okay?
Right.
That's
no,
the problem.
I was in it.
When you join the military, you're joining the gang. Rites of all the things are there, right? Well, not anymore. We've taken out all the rites of passage. Now it's all about, seriously, it's getting woke. This is why the Army, the military is having trouble recruiting. It's woke. It's not a challenge anymore. It's about feeling good. And this is why we have such a high suicide rate. But we don't weed people out anymore. But to join a gang, you got to go through. You go through some rites of passage. The military
initiation,
used to have rites
mm-hmm.
of passage.
Mm-hmm.
But the most important thing is adult leadership. People at various levels, you know, all the way up, are supervising you. At me as a martial arts instructor, I still train under the guy I go across. Tomorrow I'm going to go train under Jim Baker. I've been practicing Aikido for 27 years, teaching for 12. Tomorrow I'm going to go train with Jim Baker and his students. Jim Baker has been doing it 21 years longer than me, okay? You always mm-hmm. have to train under someone better than you, okay? That more maturity, okay? And so, you know, if you're wanting to get into, you know, guns, join a gun club. But join something that gives you human interaction.
Let's talk about the suicide. You know, I do suicide prevention for the Army, and we're losing a lot. But again, I go back to the hopelessness and the family. I was in a gang, and it was because I didn't have a functional father. And certainly the military, filled some gap in some ways. But why is there so much despair? Why is there so much fear about tomorrow that I can't make goals? I'm listless. You know, I can't plan out 10 years and be excited about making sacrifices and achieving something. I don't see that vim and vigor in my students. Very few of them.
Because Greta told you that our generation has taken away your future. You're going to die because of climate change.
Right,
yes.
Right.
Yes, the media is exacerbating the situation, okay? You have no tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no hope. Yeah, that's unfortunate. You know, when I talk to students about purpose, now, the last time I went out to field, I had about 100 cadets. This time you came with me, only a few people, and they applauded. They were excited. You know, I talked to them about not being one-dimensional and that kind of thing. But I think that we need to be surrogate parents, you know. People call me father. You know, Paul said he was a father, Father Abraham. And it's because I think there's a need to be fathered, you know, to be cared for, to be shepherded, that kind of thing. I had a student ask me the other day, are you an advisor? In other words, I don't know if they were looking for someone to give them guidance or whatever. Well, yeah, I'm an advisor, but I'm not an academic advisor. And I really think mentoring, you know, adopting, just like Will has been saying, someone, he used the terminology uncle, okay, I think is so important. One of my greatest joys is teaching in our seminary where, you know, priests and deacons are coming up, young people, and to be able to have an influence, to leave a legacy. I heard a guy the other day sharing how someone trained him up to be a Navy SEAL, and the guy died shortly after he had given him all this training. We have to leave a legacy, so we have to adopt someone that God would put in our lives, and we call it discipleship or mentoring, and help people navigate through life, you know, that it's not all fearful. Now, what our parents, you know, maybe again, happy days are here again. You know, the wars are over. You know, we don't want any more war. You know, just, you know, let all the restraints off. And I thought my parents were strict. They were older, but there was a liberality there that I was kind of surprised about. But I think, you know, you want to cast off any kind of ugliness that everyone went through. I had several uncles in the Second World War. My wife's one uncle was at Normandy. And so I think we have to take some responsibility and giving them guidance. You know, Rich, when you used to be an Army historian, I was always so impressed at how passionate, enthusiastic you were about your job, how you loved it, I don't see that kind of love in young people for what they're choosing to do. There's an ambivalence. I talked to a student today. You know, there's somewhat of an ambivalence, and I think it's partly due to what you said. They're really not sure there is a future. And we've got to share with them a future and a hope.
I love what you're saying, Father Michael. We got to share with them a future and a hope. The issue, though, that we have to start to realize is that we can't actually articulate what that might look like in a physical realm. The only way we are able to do that is if we talk spirituality, if we talk the concepts. That's the only way it works. If we start getting into, like, the real-world concepts, what we find is that it falls away very quickly. And so over time, what I find myself wanting to do is to stay talking about the spirituality part of it, because that's one of the places that we all can connect. We all have a Holy Spirit that tends to stir us in moments that we're troubled, or tends to give us that feeling of great advice when we need it at that right time. And it also allows us to connect with our brothers and sisters in a way that in the real world, it doesn't seem to work. We all know that feeling of being in a spiritual service where we're connecting and the Spirit is moving and things are flowing through us. That's where I tend to want to go. And I find that when I'm with someone one-on-one, and when I'm with you and all the people that might be listening out there, I would tell you that I have decided to agree with myself that I am a spiritual being having a human experience, and that if I'm able to look at my brother in love, no matter who he or she or whatever they may decide is their pronoun might be, if I just look at them in love first and realize that's the state that I want to be in and everything else goes from there, I find that that provides me a lot more peace and gives me a great connection point if I see my brother or sister as Jesus would have me see them and not maybe as the world would have them see them. And I try to practice that every day. And it tends to work over time. I'm proud of my life and where I'm at so far, you know?
I've dealt with a lot of lawless people that were doing things that were both destructive to themselves and to their loved ones. And so I think part of that, and I'm all for accepting and sharing God's grace and love for them, that Jesus died for them. But I also think that we've got to give a sobering warning that there are consequences. There's a law of reciprocity. You reap what you sow. You know,
Amen.
Those of us who lived during the 60s, we see how a lot of the structures that were broken down, a lot of things we can look at from those dates and see how they were eroded. So I'm not saying we shouldn't have a love fest or shouldn't share, but I think we have to be sober as to how hard life really is, especially without God. But even with God, and I just think Rich said it earlier about basic training, if we don't challenge people, they don't feel like they've accomplished anything if it's just handed to them. And so we do have, and it's great to be able to have a good life to look back on. Scripture says we're to consider those who have gone before us and imitate their lives. So, Will, that's wonderful to say, like Paul could say, follow me as I follow Christ, but not to sugarcoat it, okay, because it's not a love fest. There's a lot of, you know, I lost a daughter at 24 years old 6 years ago. There's a lot of heartache in life, but we have to know. That's why Scripture says that we're to learn about our Creator when we're young, because when we get older, we may not have delight in the days. I mean, life is hard if we're honest. And I just think that we need to be honest with them, not like, oh, I had it so hard, so you have to have it harder. I would tell people that I've mentored, look, this took me 9 years to learn. I can teach it to you in 4, just like Rich is saying with the martial arts. I think, you know, we want to be there to enable them. I'm so excited when these seminary students of mine that are now ordained came to my house. They left with all kinds of books in their hands, hopefully wisdom. And this is, you know, we have a stewardship for the next generation. But to be totally honest and not sugarcoat whatever they might have to face in life, because there are consequences, and some of them are not sober. There's a real kind of frivolity, if that's the right word. There's kind of a lack of seriousness about what it really takes to accomplish things in life. You know, we call it sweat equity. And so, you know, I think we have to rise up and realize they're misguided. And as Rich pointed out, there's a lack of fatherhood. There's a wonderful book on the power of fatherhood. But I know that's why I joined the gang, because I didn't have a functional father. My father was 100% disabled vet, was either in prison, jail, VA hospital. You know, when he was home, you know, throwing us out of the house. I mean, it was a rough thing. And some of these people don't have uncles or don't have members in their church that'll stand beside them. Unfortunately, you know, there's been Scouts, Cub Scouts and Boy Scouts and Eagle Scouts. But unfortunately, people have preyed on our young people. Pedophiles, for instance. I heard one say, if you won't love them, I'll love them my way. And they said they waited at bus stations, like in San Francisco, when kids were running away. So we've got to rescue them, but we've got to also give them a dose of reality of what it takes to build. You know, there's a great saying. It said it's better to build a boy than to have to repair a man.
Amen. Amen. Father Michael, look, your advice is just like we need to bronze it in gold and put it on a shelf and listen to it over and over again. Thank you for sharing. That was great. You're spot on. You're spot on, right? You can't look at your kid every day and tell them they're a fairy, superstar, unicorn. You got to say no. You got to go out and weed the flower bed and water the grass if you want it to grow. Otherwise, you know, you got to do that. And your advice is spot on. Spot on. Thank you for sharing.
Thank you, Will.
Well, on that note, okay. The Army, I think it was my last trip to Iraq that turned out suicide, that more soldiers were dying of suicide than IEDs or enemy contact. And overall in the Army, suicides were high. And people thought, you know, the first assumption is that it was because of the high op tempo, operational tempo, you know, mm-hmm. repeated deployments to the combat zone. So they investigated all the suicides in the Army. It turns out the vast majority of the people who committed suicide in the Army had not even deployed. I say that is, holy crap, something's missing here. When my book, The Filthy 13, came out, George Koskamaki, who was a author of three books about the 101st during World War II, because he served in the 506th of the 101st, and he said there are, you know, even though there is a lot of great units, the 504th made three combat jumps, the 509th started jumping and parachuting into combat zones in North Africa. It's the first unit to make combat jumps. It made all the mistakes. Find a book about the 509th. You won't. And what George Koskamaki said was, there are more books about the 506 parachute infantry regiment, any other airborne unit in World War II. And I thought about that. And he was right. And they just kept coming out. And Band of Brothers was easy, Company 506. And that helped exacerbate the thing. But when he made that comment, the miniseries of the Band of Brothers had not come out yet. Okay. And when I looked at the training of the 506, it was intense. Colonel Zink knew he had to weed out physically and mentally anybody that was weak. And if you look at all the commando courses, Ranger School, Special Forces, SEALs, BUDS Corps, or SAS, they are designed not to physically weed you out, but mentally.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, when our Army got soft, that we were appealing to a generation of people who were awarded participation trophies. Y'all know what I mean by participation trophy.
Yeah, I tell my class that all the time.
You compete in any kind of tournament, you're going to get a medal whether you won anything or not. There's no accomplishment. There's no sense of accomplishment. All right.
No merit.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. All right. All right. Remember this name, Jason Everman. Jason Everman. Go on YouTube, type in Jason Everman. The guy was a guitarist in two grunge bands, Soundgarden and Nirvana. He got kicked out of Nirvana first, then he joined Soundgarden, got kicked out, all because he's moody and stuff like that. When you listen to his talk on TED, and he explains, I mean, he was lit, but the life everybody thought was, a reach for sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and it didn't satisfy him. And one of his mentors was a Navy SEAL, and the guy said what he did in the Navy was far better than anything else he had ever achieved. So the guy enlists in the Army, goes into the Rangers. And then 9/11 happens. He's in Afghanistan. After he finishes his 3 years as an Army Ranger, he goes into Special Forces, does two enlistments in Special Forces, okay? And he talks about it. And he said the formula is really simple, all right? We talk about sacrifice, struggle leads to accomplishment and satisfaction. You can't make, you think you're making people feel good by giving them a trophy. No, you're not. You're cheating them. You are cheating them. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So when we're talking to our audience, okay, they're listening to the show. If you're part of that lost generation, you have no social contact, join an organization. I'm an advocate for the martial arts. Okay, if you want to get a gun or whatever, join a gun club. But join something where there are people who can mentor you. Pass the fact that Disney Channel taught you that adults are stupid. They're not. They made all the stupid mistakes you are going to make unless you listen to them. Now, for those of you out there who are in a position of mentorship like me, okay, so this is part I'm going to brag about. So, I don't factory teach martial arts. I look at every one of my students. I sit down and I ask every now and then, ask my student, what is your goal? What is your goal? All right? So each one of them is different, and I appeal to each one of them, okay? Daniel started with me, when he was 16. This guy, he's going to go the traditional route. He's going to be getting ready to test for his black belt. He'll be my first student to test for a black belt. And I don't have a black belt because I don't test. But anyway, he's going to test. He can go all the way to Shihan, okay? Naoko, she was with me when I was training under Pat Left, She's Okinawan, doesn't believe in I don't know if she doesn't believe in any spirituality God, but hey, it's the cultural thing. She's Okinawan and she wants to participate in something low intensity, Aikido is low intensity, and It's Japanese, and Okinawa is now part of Japan, and I always refer to her as like the den mother of our, you know, as long as I have Naoko, I have a dojo. I got one person, okay? Amanda, she doesn't want to test. She loves sparring. There's an intellectual side to this. It challenges every facet of your brain, okay? So we train with that. And, Yori, you know, he's new. He's been training for 3 years with, another marsh with Aikido, and he's joined me. The traditional route will go through the testing. He'll fall. So him and Daniel will probably be my black belts that inherit the dojo. And then I just got a new student, Melissa, who is in her 60s. Her body has been broken. She's a karate instructor, been teaching for a long time. Found Aikido is very interesting. And the thing is, you know, I'm like, she has the experience level I have. I'm like, I don't look at her as a beginner. I'm looking at her as, hey, look, you can help. You can bring a different set of eyes in assessing my students. I consult with her all the time about this. And then she's a computer nerd. Oh, I'm posting these instructional videos on YouTube. She's now developing, you know, where she's filming or sparring and our videos, and she's editing it and stuff like that. So, you know, for those of you out there who are in the position who can mentor, okay? For those of you who need mentors, get out there and join those organizations, all right?
Because people love to share what they know. I teach a five-hour class once a month. It's a seminary class. And, I mean, it's thrilling to know that they're going to take on your passion, your vision, and you're going to help them. Because what took you many years to learn, maybe the hard way, you can help them to avoid that. And it's very gratifying on both sides. But usually when you're ready, right, at least in the martial arts, it said the teacher appears.
No, when the student is ready, the teacher appears. You're right.
Yeah,
and
that's what I said.
You're leaving out the fact you're teaching seminary, but you also teach college.
Yeah.
You have this passion. That is your – look, when you told me you had a successful military career ahead of you, that you had a calling to leave that to go into academia, okay? So it isn't just seminary, but you're teaching
right.
College. You're teaching college students.
And I
we
just think that – go ahead, James.
This is Will. We were talking earlier about suicide, and I thought it was interesting. I looked up suicide rates per 100,000. I thought it was interesting to find out that the United States male suicide rate is 22.4 out of 100,000.
True.
And that
military also.
United Kingdom suicide rate is 10.4 out of 100,000. So basically half of what the United States is. The UK suicide rate is half of that. Vietnam is 10. Venezuela is literally 3.7, and Turkey is 3.6. It's really wild to look at some of these numbers. Sri Lanka, the suicide rate in Sri Lanka is pretty much about the same as ours. The Solomon Islands is 32.2 per 100,000. Russia has a suicide rate of 38.2, so almost double of ours is in Russia. South Korea is 30, where ours
really?
Is 22.
I've been
it's
there.
Wild looking numbers, yeah. Mexico, Ours is 22. Mexico's 8.7. Mexico has way less suicide than we do.
All right. I love that.
Kuwait,
okay.
3.8. Wow.
Okay. And 100,000 Americans are killing themselves with fentanyl.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
All right, 100,000 a year. All right, the thing is, we're killing ourselves. We have a lost generation. We're killing ourselves. Seriously,
yes.
We need immigration. We need it, and I'm telling you, here I want you to understand this. You mentioned Mexico. All those illegal immigrants coming into this country. Do you think? They all of them are looking for handouts. They're looking to live off the government teat. No, every illegal immigrant. Look, my wife is Hispanic, okay, and I have known a lot of illegals and legal immigrants, and I'm telling you right now, I have never known one who is willing to sit back and let the government fund their life. But I know a lot of Americans who want the government, native-born Americans who want the government to fund them, okay?
All the
immigrants that come into this country want to succeed. Those that I know, they work 2 and 3 jobs, and they go to college at the same time. They want to get ahead,
right.
or if they don't want to do that, they're going to harass so that their kids will have that opportunity. We need immigration. We just don't know how many immigrants our economy can afford. But then we got to start subtracting these who are eliminating themselves from the economy through fentanyl overdoses. Or suicide, just giving up. No, I'm being callous. This is a callous side of me. But it's a fact. You know, if you have no hope, just fucking kill yourself, because we got a lot of people who want to replace you. There are people who are sacrificing everything they've got to come into this country because there's so many opportunities that you have given up on.
You are Nostradamus in what you're saying there. 1,000%. Okay, look, I was talking to my buddy the other day, and you're like 1,000. We have people pouring across the border begging for jobs, and we have people that are self-medicating with any kind of drug they can find and ending up with fentanyl and killing themselves. And so my buddy, I mean, he was joking, but he was sick as hell. But it's kind of exactly what you're saying, but you're saying it way nicer in that fentanyl is killing all these
nice
people.
I was being nice.
Let me be nice, okay? But the point is you're right.
All right. Okay.
Your point is you're right. You're right.
I'm really shocked because I lived in South Korea. That it's as high as it is because it's so developed, and it just really intrigues me. I have a guy in my Bible studies, a PhD student from Korea, nice family. You know why? I think we need to ask. Now, I know some of the young Koreans that I worked with there, the Katusas, you know, they were really eager to come to America and so on and so forth, but it's shocking that it's that high there because it's such a developed and a pretty much a Christian nation, at least 60% wise. You know, there's some void there, and God has to help us to, you know, do something as long as we're here to reach out to people.
Right.
But I'm really shocked. Thank you for providing those.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So
Canada is 15. Again, we're 22, but Canada's 15. Brazil's 10, half of what we are.
Mm.
Bosnia is 13, half of what we are. Wow, it's wild. Bahrain is at 10. The Bahamas is 5 out of 100,000 people. And I'm moving to the Bahamas, man. Nobody commits suicide in the Bahamas.
How can you want to kill yourself if you live in an island paradise like the Bahamas?
Right. It's like nothing but island bands.
Come on,
and
people
take
vacations there.
Yeah. Hey, I just
look,
wanted to say.
North Korea's only 10. North Korea's half of ours.
Huh.
I mean, I don't know what the numbers are. Let me find some big numbers. Guyana's 65. Kazakhstan's 30. Kiribati's 53. Lesotho's 146. Dude, they kill everybody. Whatever Lesotho is, wherever that is.
Lebanon's only Italy?
59. Italy, where's Italy?
Hey, we're getting close to the end of the show. All right. This is the last thing I want to say. All right. No, I want to say this. Will, I've been busting on you, but I love you, man. Love you as a brother.
I love you too, man.
Okay. Yeah, you're a worthy adversary. All right. So,
I just want to say that.
Don't take anything.
Yeah, go ahead, guys.
Yeah.
I just want to say, don't take anything personal, which I don't think you did, okay? I think we've had fun with it. So I think it's time for everybody to close out the show.
All right. Yeah. So we like to end the show with a prayer. We always ask Father Mike to pray for America, and that's what we're doing right now. So, Father Mike, could you please pray for America, and we'll –
Absolutely. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, Lord, we pray for hope to those who feel not only but hopeless. Lord, I pray for young people that are misguided, young people that are fearful. I pray, Lord, that we would be good examples as men and as Christians. I pray a blessing over all of our audience, how faithful they are. And I pray that something we said tonight could be a help to them. We do pray for our president, for our country, for those children that are dying from fentanyl. Lord, I know the pain. I'm losing my own daughter. And I just pray, Lord God, that we would draw closer to you and be full of purpose. Bless these men, I pray, in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen. So, Will, I wanted to tell you thank you for coming on tonight's show and hanging with us for the full 2 hours. And as Rich was saying, you know, it was a great opportunity. I'd like to give you an opportunity to give any parting thoughts, and then we will say our goodbyes.
Father Mike, you are the man. I love you, dude. Richard Kilblaine, I have enjoyed discussing things with you, and I'll tell you what,
argue it. I love arguing. Yes, it was fun.
Your spirit comes through. And James, I love you, man. You are a stud among studs, and I just hope. Pick up the crumbs of love that you've left behind. If y'all haven't, y'all go find the essay where I wrote about James and what he did to all of my students and me. As a matter of fact, I was like, I stepped up tough when he stepped up on those bus steps to get a little elevation and tells all of his peers, I hope you get a platoon of soldiers just as sorry as each one of you are. And at that moment, I was like, this guy is my guy right here. This guy is my guy. So, James, thanks for having me on. It's been a pleasure, Father Mike. Richard Kilblaine, you're a stud and a mentor. Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
All right, gentlemen. God bless you all, and God bless America, folks. And we love you. We love
Amen.
You. We really do. That's why we're here.
Amen.
Good night, everyone. Good night.